Are we connected? Yes. Sanjeechuna sojeechuna la chaha bado dane cha sanjeedagye jinsojipe sunan tola penje sanjeetupai shuwa sanjeechuna sojeechuna la chanjo bado dane cha sanjeetagye Tage jinso jibe sunan jindu la penje sanje dupai shu sanje chunan soje chunan la chanjo badu dani chasanji Tage jinso jibe sunan jindu la penje sanje dupai shu So good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for making the efforts to come here. Today we are going to deal a little bit about the path of meditation. Hope, courage, and determination. Right. Are anybody here not Buddhist? Okay. Is there anyone here who doesn't know anything about Buddhism? So you're not Buddhist, but you know. Good. So one thing that we all know, therefore, is that basically, the Buddhist path deals with the mind. It's not so interested in, external factors as the mind which perceives those external factors. And so, honestly, in our society nowadays, the way it's presented is that all our problems basically are due to external factors. Other people, our job, the climate, the government, the world in general. It's always somehow something outside of ourselves, mostly which we have no control over, but which we are given permission to grumble about. And, of course, for many people, external circumstances are very overwhelming in their difficulties, in their seeming complexities. And so people become increasingly stressed, increasingly depressed, increasingly a sense of helplessness as society rushes along. And we're all swept along with it. So, therefore, on the one hand, as we all know, our modern life is more and more distracted, more and more pressure, less and less ability just to be with what is, because there are 10,000 things which have to be attended to at the same time. And yet, at the same time, along with that, on a positive note, has grown up this interest in dealing with the mind, of interest now in meditation and in mindfulness and in trying to deal with this stressed-out mind from a purely therapeutic point of view, not particularly from a spiritual point of view, but nonetheless the information coming back from neuroscience and so forth is the very encouraging news that we change our attitude, basically we change the world. And so today we're going to deal just a little bit, just absolutely skimming the surface. It's in a cappuccino, it's not even all the foam. It's just the first layer of chocolate. for dealing with how to deal with our mind during the day. So the first thing to remember is really we tend to make this division between our spiritual preoccupations and then everyday life. And so, you know, when we go to the Dharma Center, when we're sitting in this lovely temple, when we're meditating, when we're reading a spiritual book, that is Dharma. Dharma means the Buddha's teaching in this context. That is spiritual. And then the rest of the day with our families, in our workplace, in our social life, that is worldly activity. So therefore we have this division between nirvana and samsara, right? One side nirvana, little, and then huge, great big samsara glaring at us. And then we feel discouraged because, you know, samsara seems so overwhelming and our little bit of nirvana is so small. So the only way to deal with this is really to turn our samsara into nirvana. In other words, to really use our daily life as our Dharma practice. If we cannot merge our everyday life, our everyday mind is what it really means, with the Dharma, we ain't getting nowhere. This is very important. Really, really. Our outside circumstances are unlikely to change that much. But there can be an internal revolution. Then everything changes. So today we're just going to deal with this a little bit. I mean, it's of course a huge task. I mean, people think that if they sit, you know, they go for a weekend meditation course or they do half an hour a day's practice, that somehow, you know, after at least 6 months, something must have happened. Good gracious, I've been doing this now for a year. Woo! And it's very important to recognize that this is usually a very slow process. Despite the Eckhart Tolles of this world, it actually takes time because it is the mind is very deeply habituated to its misconceptions. And it takes time to reprogram ourselves. This is why it needs hope, courage, and determination. Especially determination. Because, you know, just recently when we were in Sydney, some very kind people put on a classical concert for us to raise some funds for my nunnery back in India. And they invited professional singers, sopranos, baritones, and a small choir to perform various classical music, mostly Mozart. And of course, the singers were magnificent. And while they sang, they appeared to be enjoying themselves. And it appeared to come out that huge, beautiful sound seemed so effortless. But we all know they have spent hours and hours every day for years with so much effort in their practice in order to become effortless. So we all have to remember it takes a lot of effort to be effortless. That's just dealing with the voice. Or if you're a musician, with your fingers. Imagine what it takes to transform the mind. So this is not a quick fix. It's a very slow process of gradual transformation. I mean, if we saw a wild horse, we were just in Melbourne we just missed the cup, thank goodness, by one day. Okay, so apart from these well-bred horses, you're in a field, you see, you're out in the wild, you see a wild horse. Now you look at that horse and you think, wow, that horse has real potential. That could be a really good horse. But one cannot train it because it's wild. And so the first step is to tame the horse. Taming it means we quieten it down, we get it to be interested, friendly, trusting, and finally thinking, oh yeah, to be trained might be fun. But we cannot train it until it has got to that stage of being quieter and trusting. And likewise with our mind. We cannot really train our mind while it is still wild, out of control. Now, many people think their minds are in control. So, they should all do a nice little shamatha retreat. A retreat on calm abiding and sit and trying to focus on their breath for 1 minute and see how they get on. I mean, most people, when they try to actually meditate, the first thing we all discover is how totally out of control the mind really is. That it will focus for, you know, a few seconds, or even if you're lucky, a few minutes. And then when it gets bored with the subject of meditation, which is usually the breath, which is not that terribly exciting, it will just go off again on its own little journeys. And the rest of the meditation center is spent trying to bring it back. Then it goes off, and then you bring it back, and then it goes off, and then you bring it back. And then people say, my mind used to be okay until I tried meditating. But until we recognize there's a problem, we won't look for a solution. And that goes for everything. So we have to understand that our problems, really, we blame outside people, we blame outside circumstances, but really whatever happens to us, what counts for our well-being or our distress is really the response of our mind. And that if we really can get our mind, become the masters of our mind instead of the slaves of our mind and our emotions, then things, you know, yeah, of course, good things happen, bad things happen, but good or bad are relative terms. If we are centered and clear, we can deal with whatever happens in a skillful way. Actually, our whole life depends on our mind. I mean, this is so important to understand, because we think that our happiness depends on external circumstances, and we confuse happiness with pleasure. So if we think, you know, society tells us that if we have constant pleasurable sensations, that we will be happy. So we spend so much time and energy on accumulating comfort for the body. Nice food, healthy food, delicious food for our taste. Beautiful visual images, lovely sounds, beautiful smells. Exciting mental stimulus. We put so much effort. So why aren't we happy? Why are so many people living on medication? Just to keep their mood up. You know, I hardly know a single American who doesn't have a therapist. It's like a dentist, you know. Everybody has their private dentist and they compare notes. Everybody has a therapist. It's like normal. How can you go through life without your therapist? So, if one has genuine mental problems and traumas, that a therapist can be very, very helpful. I'm not putting down psychotherapy. But I'm saying, why does the whole, you know, at a certain level of economic stability, why does everybody feel they need a therapist? And for most of us, we can be our own therapist, actually, once we begin to understand the mind. And the only way to understand the mind is by looking at it. So we are going to mostly talk today about this, the question of, if you read Dharma books, traditional Dharma books, they assume, basically, they are talking to an audience of monks and hermits. So therefore, it's always assumed you've got endless time to do nothing except formal practice. But nowadays, as we can see, I mean, this is a monastery, so of course we have all these nuns and a few monks, but normally the audience would be 99% lay people. This is probably the first time in Buddhist history this has happened, actually, because it's not only in Australia. But if one goes to Singapore or Taiwan or Korea, the same thing. Yes, you have a section of the Sangha, but the vast majority are highly educated and motivated lay people who come asking the question, how can the Dharma help me? And the fact that the subject today is on meditation and yet so many people come, personally I think is very encouraging. If one reads the early Pali Canon, one sees that the Buddha very, very much emphasized that the strength of the Dharma, of the Buddha Dharma, rests on the fourfold Sangha. The fourfold Sangha are fully ordained monks, fully ordained nuns, lay men, lay women. So both monastic and lay, the Buddha gave his emphasis to. And he says, and just before he died, he repeated that as long as the fourfold Sangha studies, practices, and propagates the Dharma, for that long, the Dharma will stay strong and flourish. He did not say, it just depends on the monks. Nowhere does he say, only monks can study, practice, and propagate. But somehow it got into the preserve of the monks, who of course had the time for deep study and practice. But nonetheless, this was not the Buddha's original intention. And I think it's very interesting that now we are coming back to the original intention of the Buddha, which was that the lay people also should be very involved, not just in supporting the Sangha, the monastic Sangha, which is a very important part of the role of a lay person, but also themselves engaging in the study, practice, and propagation. Everybody should be in it together. But of course, as a lay community, you have so many calls on your time, apart from strict retreats and study programs. So therefore, we have to think, how is the Dharma going to transform your lives, despite the fact you don't have so much time for just formal studies and practices? The good news is that it can. The bad news is that it's a challenge. The first thing we all need to do, as I said, back to the example of a horse, is to tame the mind. That's the crux of the matter. As long as our minds are distracted, which means that our attention span is very short, for so long we will not be able to genuinely go deeper into the practice. It's like if you think of an ocean, then mostly we are on the surface of the ocean, and the waves go up, the waves go down, sometimes happy, sometimes sad, up, down, up, down, up, down. It's the nature of an ocean to have waves. And so our mind, our emotions, our feelings, sometimes up, sometimes down, sometimes up, sometimes down. But because it's on the surface, if we try to see things clearly, the situation outside clearly, the situation inside clearly, it's very difficult because the surface is so turbulent. We can't see very far. You look into the surface of the ocean, you only see down a very short level because it's constantly moving and you know, the foam and the debris, it's all just very turbulent there. So in order to sink below the ocean level, to really go down to deeper levels of the ocean and see what's really living in that ocean, all the beautiful creatures living in the ocean and all the terrible creatures living in the ocean, you know, both, just to really understand what's going on in that ocean, first we need to calm the surface. And that allows us to go down deeper and deeper. As long as our minds are very turbulent, as long as our minds are totally distracted, we cannot go deep. We cannot see what's really going on in our minds, and yet it is our minds which control our lives. Identical things happen to different people, and their response is very different. And that is not to do with the circumstances, it's to do with their inner attitude. So if we want to find happiness, we cannot depend on it coming through mere sensory pleasures. That is a very impermanent happiness. And after a while, you know, you see people living in beautiful houses, they've got everything they could possibly want, and they're so miserable. I mean, I know a number of very wealthy people, and some of them, you know, are alcoholics. Why? If getting more and more and more gives so much bliss, how is it that they're so desperate? So any of us who have any sense at all can see. And this is the advantage of living in a prosperous country. Believe me. You can see that merely getting more and more and more of the same does not result in deeper and deeper levels of satisfaction. Sociologists have come to the same conclusion. Everybody, except the Milarepas of this world, who are few, need a basic level of secure existence. They need somewhere to live. We need somewhere, enough food that we're not worrying where the next meal will come from. We need enough to clothe our bodies, to protect us from the heat, to protect us from the cold, so that we're not endlessly thinking about money all the time, that we have enough to educate the kids, enough for basic security. That brings a kind of, you know, sense of well-being. But beyond that, a third car after you already have two, even more clothes, a bigger house, it just doesn't give back the same results of deep inner happiness that it did when you first got your own little house all to yourself. And so this has been shown now to be true, that you get more and more and more and more, and the satisfaction returns are less and less and less and less. So, as I say, the advantage of being in an affluent country like Australia is that you can see that. If we live in a poor country like India, then for so many people, even though they are told that this is true, they don't really believe it. And it's still glittering there, if only. They look at these Bollywood movies and they think, oh, if only I had, if only. And nothing to disprove it, because they don't know anybody who lives like that. But you all know people who live like that, yeah? So therefore, this is a big advantage, that we can see that just getting more and more and more is not going to lead to satisfaction. And that happiness, genuine happiness, is not contingent on external factors. It depends on our attitude of mind, how our mind is. If our mind is settled and positive and has some meaning to our life, some purpose, then we become strong. We become courageous. But if only meaning in life is to satisfy our endless wants, then we become dispirited in the end. The Buddha said that greed, desire, is like salty water. And the more we drink, the thirstier we become. We never get satisfied drinking salty water. However thirsty we are, we just become more thirsty. Doesn't solve the problem. So always we come back. How to deal skillfully with the mind so that we have a happy mind. Even in the face of difficulties, we can maintain our equanimity. So as this is about meditation, I would say that the first thing to do, therefore, is to deal with how to make the mind two things. One thing, more calm and settled, and at the same time, more able to keep focus. Because in our daily life, these are very important qualities as part from in our practice. They say nowadays that the average attention span of a child in the United States is 2 to 4 seconds. That is frightening. But you see it in the images, you know, that are shown. Everything is like this now. And you're doing this, and at the same time you're doing something else, and then, you know, you're kind of talking, and you all know this. I'm just telling you to remind you, but you all know. You go into restaurants and everybody's sitting around with their little iPhones, you know. Even at the classical concert that I mentioned, the lady next to me was, you know, what's the word? When you texting, yes. So I put my hand out over hers, smiled at her, and she went, oh, and she put it away. How can you text in the middle of Mozart? According to Buddhist psychology, we can only have one thought moment, one moment of consciousness at a time. Now, consciousness is going very, very fast, of course. But nonetheless, at each moment, there is only one moment of consciousness. So therefore, if we multitask and give, you know, a few moments. What it happens is that you're not doing something simultaneously, but what is actually happening is the mind is switching back and forth. So of course you get stressed. But not only do we get stressed, but we become inefficient and make mistakes. Now there are many studies on this. The results of all this multitasking, of trying to do too many things all at the same time, and not giving any sufficient attention to what is happening in the moment, which is actually the only thing that is happening. What happens, of course, is that the mind becomes extremely stressed out. And as I say, the work is not done well. Mistakes arise. And in the end, it ends up being far less efficient than if they had just, you know, even a few minutes to one task, then the next task, then the next task. It's not cutting corners. It actually ends up being taking more time because you have to go back and correct all the mistakes you made. So apart from being completely, you know, worn out by the end of the day, the mind is not planned for that. But if we think that just giving our attention to one activity at a time would be inefficient, I would say that some of you may have heard of Goenka's Vipassana courses. So his teacher, Goenka's teacher, was a Burmese named Ubakin, and Ubakin was a high-level government official. He was a high-level government official, but he also ran a meditation center. Now, when Ubakin died, when he passed away, they needed 3 people to take over his job in the government, because he was accomplishing so much, as well as running his meditation center. Why? Because his mind was so focused. Often what happens, we are so inefficient. We're doing one thing and we're thinking 1,000 other things. Try it. Try doing one thing. Start with something very simple. Combing your hair, brushing your teeth, drinking a cup of tea. And just rest the mind on what you're doing. And don't think about anything else. And don't think about what you're doing. Just know what you're doing. This is called mindfulness. Of course, mindfulness is not just knowing what you're doing. It's knowing what you're doing in a positive state of mind. For example, you know, if you're a burglar, right, and you're going into a house and you're dealing with the safe, of course, you're very mindful. But that is not counted as being right mindfulness. Correct mindfulness. Correct mindfulness means doing an action, but with a positive state of mind, with a wholesome state of mind. But nonetheless, the point is that if we could just relax the mind enough that when we do something, we know we're doing it without thinking about it, without elaborating it, without thinking of a thousand other things, actually. Usually the one thing you're not thinking about is what you're doing. The mind would rest. But it would be so clear. Because even when we're doing something which is pleasurable, check out. You go with friends, you're sitting, or you're by yourself, you're sitting, you have, you know, a cup of tea or coffee, you have a delicious cake which you've been saving up. And one takes the first sip, like it, don't like it, good God, we're not going to buy that one again. Cake, very yummy, too sweet, whatever. Even if it's good, even if, wow, this coffee is really fantastic, wow, this cake's really fantastic, by the third bite, you're not thinking about the cake or the coffee. I bet you. The mind's gone off again. And even while one is taking that first sip, one is comparing it with previous sips. All the coffee one drank before. Do you remember that coffee in Vietnam? Now that was really coffee. This, of course, is why as we get older, life seems to be speeding up. It's because so much of our thinking is completely stale. It's just a rethinking of what we already have thought before. We very rarely think very original thinking. Children, especially little children, everything they see is something new and fascinating, and they're not judging it. They're just interested in it. So then we all remember when we were children, the day was very long, full of new interesting things. But as we get older, it becomes less and less. We don't really see anything. We just see our version of it. And usually comparing it to what went before. So that we're not experiencing it anymore. And then people get so bored. If there's not external stimuli, they're bored. So we're going to do something about this. So the main problem is that our minds are untamed and that we are not able to remain centered and clear and calm. And so, therefore, anything which we see, we just see through the colored filters of all our emotional reactions. We don't see things how they really are. We just see our version. So, therefore, we need, first of all, to prepare the ground. I mean, some of you are going to be receiving very high tantric initiations and so forth from His Holiness the Dalai Lama or from various other lamas. But let me tell you that unless your mind is really undistracted and able to really center on what you are practicing, it's not going to work. So we need to prepare the ground first. This afternoon, I'll talk maybe a bit more about this whole Tantra thing. But this morning, we're going to talk about how to get the mind more clear and focused. In India, we have a nunnery, and the centerpiece of the nunnery is our temple, which we're actually quite proud of. It's a very beautiful temple, isn't it? Thank you. Endorsement. And everybody comes in and goes, ah! Oh. And then they all admire the beautiful murals around the wall and the statues and the decorations and the dragons around the pillars. And it's all very lovely. But that fancy temple rests on very deep foundations. We spent over a year or more digging down foundations and, you know, setting up the concrete and putting in the pipes. And it was very expensive. It took a long time, a lot of labor. And you can't go and say to people, look at these foundations. Nobody cares about foundations. They're also anxious to make the temple. But without those foundations, that temple will never survive. It will get cracks. It will get damp, especially in Indian climate. If you don't dig deep foundations, it's not going to last. So in our spiritual life, likewise, we need to dig deep foundations. It's not that exciting. It's not exotic. It's not esoteric. It's not particularly stunningly exciting to discuss with people. But it is so essential for the spiritual life. Believe me. One very high lama I knew said, if you have good shamatha, that means this calm abiding meditation where the mind is settled but one-pointed. If you have good shamatha, the rest of the Dharma is in the palm of your hands. And this is true. It's obvious. And it's not something to be hurried over. If we get the mind prepared, it's like a surgeon. You know, he has to prepare his tools, sharpen the scalpel, make sure everything is perfect, any workman, before they start working. If you have blunt, rusty, unworkable tools, how can you do a good job? And our minds are very blunt and rusty. So we have to clean them and sharpen it. This is so important, and we shouldn't rush over it. Even if in this lifetime all we ever did was get our minds nicely prepared, that would already be an incredible task. I mean, honestly and truthfully, if our minds are not ready, if our minds are wild, untamed, even if the Buddha himself was sitting in front of you, all he could say was, practice. What could he do? Our minds are not ready. So it's very important that we give our attention to our motivation, and to our application. So, when is... Okay, good. Okay, motivation. Basically, there are three levels of motivation. First of all, most people practice meditation or any spiritual discipline because they hope it's going to make them feel better. Which, I mean, none of these motivations are wrong, you understand. I mean, they're all perfectly valid, and anything that gets us going is a good thing. So most people hope that if they practice meditation, they'll feel better, and that it will solve so many of their problems, or at least they'll be able to cope better. Many people, when they go to the temple, certainly in Asia, they pray for their family. They pray that that they may have a son, never a daughter. They pray, their children will pass their exams, and so forth. I mean, their wishes are on a purely mundane level. And likewise, most people who, when they come to meditation, they're hoping that it will solve some of their problems. And, if they're having problems at work, problems with their families, problems with their own mind, that this will help to alleviate the situation, make them feel better. And also people want that if they practice or if they have ethics, good ethics, that not only this lifetime will be more smooth, but also for the future. They make lots of good karma, lots of positive energy going on. So next lifetime also, one may have a good rebirth, maybe in heaven or in a pure land, or at least come back in a good family and so forth. And next time come back more wealthy and intelligent and beautiful and have a much, much nicer time in samsara. And when one looks at it, that's valid. I mean, why not? Very, very few, maybe a few Maha Bodhisattvas, but very few people really want to be miserable. So, okay, recognizing that our happiness, unhappiness depends on our own actions of body, speech, and mind, we will try to have positive actions. And that's fair enough, I mean, this whole question of motivation. One time I had this dream that I was in a prison, and it was a huge prison. Huge. And on the top, on the penthouse suites, people were partying and laughing and enjoying themselves and having a great time. And then on various levels, in all different rooms, some people were working, some people were laughing, some people were crying, some people were fighting, some people were, all sorts of things. Every room was filled with all these different people doing different activities, happy and sad. And at the bottom were the dungeons, where there was just unmitigated misery. But I recognized that whether one was on the top or one was on the bottom, it was a prison. And also you didn't know if those people on the top, on the penthouse suites, would end up in the dungeons. It was very insecure. You just didn't know where you were going to be allotted. And so I thought, we've got to get out. We've got to get out of this. This is a prison. So I spoke to several people and said, we've got to get out of here. We've got to escape. And mostly they said, yeah, well, it's a prison, but it's not so bad. It's okay. And, you know, getting out is really difficult. Nobody gets out. It's really hard. You know, it's all right here. And eventually I found two friends, and they said, okay, we'll get out if you get out. So I said, all right, let's try. And going through this prison then, there was this stream, and there were the guards standing there, and there was a kind of flat kind of ferry. So we got into the ferry, and I was expecting that the guards would try to stop us, but they were totally indifferent. They didn't do anything. And so we went down the stream, and then we found ourselves on the outside of the prison. And so then we started running. And we were running and running and running and running. And I was just running and past all these windows, lighted up, again showing from the outside, looking in, people laughing, people crying, people working, people partying. All these endless, endless windows with their vignettes. So this aspiration to get out of samsara is the second level. Recognizing that even though samsara may or may not be pleasant, it's a prison house. And it's very, very insecure, because now, right now, we might have everything. Tomorrow something happens, we lose it all. The people that we're attached to die or leave us. The properties we have, I mean, here in Queensland, you know, you have a beautiful house full of beautiful things which you've selected so carefully, and there's a bushfire. We never know. People die all the time. They don't wait till they're 90. You know that. We all know that. But we always think it happens to somebody else. It's not happening to me and mine. When somebody that we love dies, we're shocked. Not just grieved, shocked. How could it be? But they were supposed to be here forever. They're mine. I love them. Today we're healthy. We have a little ache here. We go to the doctor. He tells us we've got cancer. Inoperable. How could it be? Other people get these terminal sicknesses, not me. So samsara is very, very insecure. Very insecure. As the Buddha said, the one thing certain about life is death. The one thing we all have in common, really, is that we are all going to die. This is why I tell people who come to me with terminal sicknesses, you're the fortunate ones. Because, yeah, we're all terminally sick, actually. But we just don't recognize it. But now you're told you have 3 months to live. That's wonderful. Now you can really think, what is important? What is not important? Clean up this life. Forgive those who harmed you or hurt you. Let it go. All our resentments. Think of the people we love. Tell them how we love them. Think of getting our mind prepared for the next life. We have this time. Isn't that wonderful? We are all in that position, but we don't believe it. And then we come back again. Oh, God, this is the thing against the bodhisattva vow. God help. We have to come back again and go through that whole process again, being a baby, going to school, getting our education, getting a job. Oh, dear. Over and then over and then over. And some people are like, get me out of this. Stop the wheel. I want to get off. And so recognizing that our unenlightened involvement in this wheel of birth and death is endless trouble, endlessly difficult. We seek to leave. Get me out. But then there's a problem. If we visualize ourselves as in sinking in a deep, thick swamp, and then after struggling very hard, eventually we get on dry land. Now I'm on dry land. And we turn back and we see all those beings who are still drowning in the swamp. Our parents, our loved ones, our children, our siblings, our best friends, our teachers, everybody, all drowning in the swamp. And we say to them, "We're really sorry you're drowning. However, I got out, and if you struggle hard, you'll get out too. So just keep going. Bye." We know we wouldn't do that. We know that we would take the fact that we are now on dry land to therefore use it to help pull out everybody else from the swamp who could connect with us. We would try to pull them out. Otherwise, what's the point of being on the dry land? We all know that. So in my dream, back to the dream, I was running outside of the prison and running and running and totally exhausted. And then I thought, no, it's true. This prison is infinite. It never ends. I'm just exhausting myself for nothing. At least in the prison it was okay. Now I'm just running for no point. I'm just going to go back into prison again. So I was about to give up and return to the prison. And then I thought, no, but wait. If I return to the prison, my friends behind me, who are only running because I am running, they will return to the prison too. And therefore, for their sake, I have to keep running. And as soon as I thought that, as soon as my aspiration changed from my own self-deliverance to thinking of helping these others with me, the prison ended. And we came to another road. The road was going this way, and we came to a road which went that way. And then a dream went on about helping beings. But the point is that. The point is, why do we want to practice? Why do we want to gain? Why do we want to wake up? We want to wake up so that we can wake up all others. We cannot wake them up if we ourselves are still asleep. We need to wake up and haven't awoken, and then we can say, "Well, come on, you're sleeping. Wake up." So this level, the third level, is the motivation of what is called bodhicitta. In Bodhi means awakening, and citta means the heart mind. That so it's like the spirit of awakening. It's like this aspiration to attain to our highest potential, which is Buddhahood. Not in order just to help ourselves, but because then we can genuinely be of benefit to others. As long as we ourselves are in ignorance, it's very difficult to wake others up from their ignorance. And that's why we need to aspire to gain genuine wisdom and knowledge out of compassion. See, the more we understand the situation, the more clearly we see the problem, the more compassion naturally arises. We don't have to try to make it arise. It will arise. Because it's like, I mean, the whole point is that our true nature is Buddha. We all have Buddha nature. We just don't see it. And so we all have this tremendous potential for, I mean, our true nature, who we really are, is something which is luminous and clear and vast and empty. Empty in the sense of vast, ungraspable. It's a genuine knowledge of seeing things how they really are, understanding who we really are, who is not who we think we are at all. And releasing this enormous wisdom and compassion potential which is within us. And then even just thinking about that, or even just glimpsing it for a moment, then we see what we do with ourselves and with each other and with the planet. We are all gods and we act like demons. That's incredibly sad, because we have this inner ability for total, genuine happiness, and we suffer so much. We suffer, we cause so much suffering for others and for the whole planet because of our ignorance. That's what compassion means. It doesn't just mean having compassion for, you know, sick little puppies. It's seeing that, you know, we have this incredible potential which we are wasting again and again and again, lifetime after lifetime. Even when all the causes and conditions come together again, we waste it. We don't wake up. We just keep sleeping and sleeping and sleeping. And sometimes the sleep is pleasant and sometimes the sleep is a nightmare, but it's all just a dream. So we have to wake up. That is our task for this life. That is the meaning of why we have this precious human life. To wake up, finally. And then wake up others. So, on that formidable note, we will go off and have a cup of tea. Mindfully. Okay? While you're drinking your tea, see how many sips you can be conscious of without commenting.